Hey, Vetfolio Voice listeners, welcome to another episode. This episode is sponsored by Hills and features Dr. Sybilla Miller. And in this episode, we talked about nutritional considerations for management of patients with chronic diarrhea. Now, of course, when we encounter a patient with chronic diarrhea, there is kind of a sense of urgency in getting them treated because oftentimes the pet is distressed, the owner is distressed, it can be maybe a little messy, but choosing the right diet for that particular patient, that can be a challenge. It's not always straightforward. Do we reach for something that's low fat, highly digestible, a combination of those? What if the patient is presenting with other comorbidities? I mean, there can be a lot of considerations to really keep in mind. Dr. Miller and I talked about some specific cases that she treated, which I love because I love when we get to talk about specific animals and their care and how they improved. But I won't give too much away. Let me tell you about Dr. Miller and we will jump in. Dr. Sybilla Miller is the MedVet Internal Medicine Specialty Team Leader and a practicing board-certified small animal internal medicine specialist at MedVet Northern Virginia. Dr. Miller attended the University of Massachusetts, where she earned a Bachelor of Science degree in Chemical Engineering. After a brief engineering career, she realized helping families and their critters was her passion. She began her veterinary journey at North Carolina State University with a year of study at, I did look up this pronunciation ahead of time, but I'm going to butcher it, so I'm going to say the Free University of East Berlin, otherwise known as, and I'm so sorry because I know I'm going to butcher this, Freie Universität East Berlin. Okay, moving on. She earned her board certification after completing her internal medicine residency at the Animal Medical Center in New York City. Her publications include the topics of choledochal cysts, a new canine fungal infection, and factors associated with canine immune-mediated hemolytic anemia. She has a special interest in gastroenterology, hematology, infectious diseases, and hepatology. Her favorite part of veterinary medicine is the relationship she fosters with families and colleagues. In her years of service to the veterinary community, she's been dedicated to bringing veterinarians together to learn more from each other and develop lifelong relationships. She's active as a leader in her local VMA as well as nationally with the ACVIM. During her free time, you will probably find her out flying, looking for the best beaches and winds for kite surfing. I did a little bit of kite surfing before I graduated high school. It is very challenging and very fun, so lots of respect for taking on that hobby. All right, let's get into our episode. So for this episode, I am so excited to be joined by Dr. Sybilla Miller, and we're going to talk about some GI symptoms here, all of our favorite topics to cover, but conditions that we see regularly in practice. So Dr. Miller, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thanks, Cassie. So happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So let's jump straight in and talk about anatomy. When we're talking about, say, small bowel symptoms versus large bowel symptoms, what are we referring to?
Yeah, this is core to getting off the ground for diarrhea and trying to figure things out. When we talk about, specifically, we're talking about canine diarrhea, we think about it in two regards. Is it originating from the first part of the intestines, the small bowel, or is it originating from the back part, basically the colon? So everything but the colon is the small bowel, and they have really important different functions. The small bowel is for digesting your food and absorbing the nutrients, and then the large bowel, it's really storage of waste and reclaiming water. So really different functions and act very differently. Knowing about that difference and the functionality will help guide us in the next steps of testing and therapy.
Absolutely. So we're talking about different functionality and therefore different symptoms when we see large bowel versus small bowel symptoms. Can you walk us through some of the signs and symptoms we might see with large bowel versus small bowel diarrhea and what important history questions we should make sure we're asking?
Absolutely. So this gets down to the nitty-gritty of working with families and their pets to try and figure out how we can help them. So if we take that concept of looking at the small bowel and the large bowel, when we look at the character of the diarrhea specifically, we think of it as stool character, defecation habits, and then some other related signs. Some big clues for us in the stool character will be for small bowel, whether you have watery diarrhea, large volume. Those will be very characteristic for the small bowel. And then for large bowel, you might see a different kind of texture, more gelatinous. You might see blood because you're close to the back end, and you might see mucus. Those would be defining characteristics for the stool character for small and large bowel. And then as far as habits of defecation with large bowel, you can imagine if you have large bowel discomfort, you can have increased frequency and urgency. So lots of bowel movements and discomfort. Whereas with a small bowel, you might have a normal frequency and maybe even a larger volume. So type of defecation or habits of defecation will be key. And then lastly, on a smaller note, the signs that you'll see for small bowel, because the small bowel handles your nutrition, might be signs of nutritional deficiency or even weight loss in severe cases.
Man, I thought I was pretty good on the signs and symptoms for small bowel versus large bowel, but the watery diarrhea, I'm glad that you brought that up, because when you said that, I started thinking and I went, you know what, that makes sense, because I do hear more of the description of like the watery diarrhea with small bowel, and then with large bowel, more soft serve, where owners start to get mad at me because then they never want to eat soft serve ice cream again.
Yep. Cow patty, soft serve.
Yes.
Lots of descriptions. We'll come back to that. But yeah, descriptions
Absolutely.
Are super important.
Yes. Owners love that. And it's funny because I think it's like second nature to us in the exam room to ask these mm-hmm. questions. And then some owners will just jump right in and it's great. But mm-hmm. others, you can tell they're a little shy about making these descriptions. And then, like I said, they get upset about not wanting to eat soft serve ice cream again. Let's do one of my favorite things, which is jump into some cases. And so the first case we're going to talk about is Mongo. And from what I understand, he's a beautiful white German shepherd who was diagnosed with small bowel diarrhea. I could imagine that was probably pretty messy. How did Mr. Mongo initially present?
So Mongo, as you described, is a, he's about two now, white German shepherd, absolutely gorgeous, about 60 pounds. And when he presented, he had been through multiple families, owned for only 3 months, and really had really, really severe diarrhea, a lifetime of diarrhea. His family had tried multiple different approaches. And when he came in, although he looked happy and comfortable, he was skin and bones. You think of a skeleton, he was skin and bones.
I can only imagine a whole lifetime of that.
It was awful. Yeah. His diarrhea was very watery. He didn't have any accidents, no straining. He didn't have any mucus or blood on his stool. And because he was skinny, we know he was malnourished despite having a good appetite and no vomiting. He was skin and bones. So his presentation is really very characteristic for what we see for small bowel.
And I would imagine the number one consideration in that presentation would be, how do we address this malnourished state that he's in? Keeping that in mind, assuming I'm right, feel free to tell me I'm wrong. What types of nutritional considerations would we want to keep in mind when we're treating, you know, a dog like this who is malnourished because he just hasn't been able to absorb anything?
So for a guy like this, we're going to look at something else that's absorbing his nutrition. So we want to make sure he doesn't have parasites, a heavy worm burden. We want to make sure he doesn't have any other metabolic diseases or anything else going on. So the biggies for looking at what's going on with him would be to make sure we do kind of some core diagnostics of fecal testing, and then maybe a CBC, serum chemistry panel, urinalysis, you know, just the basics to get started. And then if the family wanted to move forward, then we could do some more advanced testing. But in looking at him, just looking at him in person and with his symptoms, we know he has malabsorption. And I know this puppy, he didn't have parasites. They tested and treated. So I knew he didn't have parasites and he had some core diagnostics. So working to your question of what nutritional considerations for him, we want something that's really highly digestible, right? We don't want something that's going to just keep going right through him. We want something that's likely hypoallergenic if we can, so that we're not having any allergic or sensitivity reactions to the food. would be where I would start with that.
Can I ask you real quick, because you mentioned something about something else eating his food, so to speak, and parasites.
Yeah.
In a dog this size, have you seen parasite burdens high enough to cause this sort of malnutrition?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You'd be surprised how many worms a dog can have.
Yes, it's a scary thought. I feel like when I see those heavy parasite burdens, I think of, you know, those super anemic little puppies, but a 60-pound mm-hmm. German Shepherd. Now that you mention it, I did one time see a German Shepherd with a PCV of 17% from flea anemia.
Yeah, holy cow. Yep. And I don't want to overlook the core things, the most common things, before I diverge into those things that are more my specialty, like inflammatory bowel disease and food intolerance and those kind of things. I want to make sure I cover those core things that are most common.
So you mentioned something highly digestible and hypoallergenic and things along those lines. Could you give us some examples of types of foods that might be appropriate in that scenario?
Oh, yeah, we have a lot of different options. You can have a hydrolyzed protein. You can have something like a hydrolyzed soy diet. We have a lot of highly digestible GI diets, prescription GI diets. Those are really good. For this dog, they had in mind and had him on a really high energy diet, which was really, really high in protein and didn't have any fat. So that wasn't helping him either. But for him, what he really thrived on was a hydrolyzed protein diet that really worked really well for him.
What did his diagnosis end up being, just out of my own curiosity?
It's interesting that you ask, because this family came to me having spent a lot of money and they were really cost constrained. And so for him, I was not able to move forward with additional diagnostics like an ultrasound or endoscopy. We did a diet trial for him, and fortunately we won on our first try.
Oh, amazing.
He did very well. We added cobalamin and some probiotic therapy. And then the other thing we had to look at really carefully is how many calories does a 60-pound German Shepherd dog need to gain 10 or 15 pounds? It's a lot of calories.
Usually we're trying to get them to take off 10 or 15 pounds.
Yeah, absolutely. So for this guy, it took us almost 3 months for him to gain 15 pounds just to catch up with where he was before.
Wow. What kind of therapeutic food did Mongo do best on?
So Mongo's nutritional needs ended up being the requirement for a highly digestible food and something hypoallergenic. So hydrolyzed soy protein is what we finally landed on. And then lastly, he needed a really high caloric content, so we increased the volume of food he was fed.
So it sounds like overall a happy ending for Mongo.
Absolutely. He's doing really well, and he's finally in his forever home.
Oh, I love that for him. So the next one we have is an interesting one. This is Pax, and this brave guy was a service dog in Afghanistan, and unfortunately, he came back with large bowel diarrhea. So how did Pax present?
So Pax is a wonderful, wonderful retired German Shepherd, over 100 pounds, so you can imagine, quite intimidating, gorgeous fellow. He had presented to our ER for severe vomiting and bloody diarrhea after getting in the trash. And with further investigation, it was noted that he had a part of a plastic spatula in his stomach, and he had had diarrhea for quite some time. So the ER team admitted him, did some basic diagnostics and fecal tests, treated him supportively, and discharged him the next day. Because of cost constraints and because he got better, his family elected to monitor him, but he continued to have persistent diarrhea. So his family sought out help and came to see us. He had some vomiting here and there. He had good body condition. His diarrhea was characterized by having occasional blood, persistent mucus, soft to gelatinous, and a lot of frequency. They had previously attributed the frequency to his being very active, because he was always on alert and active. And they thought, well, he wants to go out. No, he needs to go. So there was some time needed to kind of characterize his diarrhea. So that's when he came to see us.
And I have to ask about the spatula. Did the spatula come out of his stomach?
Oh, don't. That's for later in the story.
Sorry. I won't spoil it. Okay. Well, I will be on the edge of my seat waiting to hear about the spatula, because it doesn't sound like a spatula in the stomach would cause these types of symptoms. No. So tell us a little bit more about Pax.
So yes, he did come to us for endoscopic removal of the spatula, but after a discussion of how we would spend money and thousands of dollars, we talked about kind of what might be happening with him and came back to our discussion of parasites, food intolerance, dietary indiscretion, maybe dysbiosis with bacterial changes. And in the shepherd, you can see stress colitis. So we talked about a lot of those different things and how would we approach things moving forward. And also recognizing that this is a family who has volunteered to take in an animal who is just a really marvelous creature and who we really want to honor, but at the same time, wanting to be judicious with financial resources and really focus on getting him back on track as fast as possible.
Absolutely. And I'm glad that you bring that up, because finances are a really important consideration in almost all of our cases. You know, we want to make sure that we're targeting our therapies and our diagnostics. So I'm glad that you bring that up in these cases, that has to be a consideration. So from a nutritional point of view, what kind of food did you reach for with Pax?
So for Pax, he was in good body condition, maybe even tending to be a little heavy. So for him, we were not really worried about malabsorption, because he had a beautiful coat and good body condition. But we really wanted him to have a consistent food without treats. He got a lot of treats. He's loved and spoiled. We wanted for him to have really a highly digestible, excellent quality diet, and maybe also look at a single protein source or a hypoallergenic food.
How did Pax do with those nutritional changes?
So for Pax, yeah, we had to make a lot of changes, and some of them were lifestyle, as I mentioned, with the treats. The food, fortunately, we have a lot of really good options. So the food was honestly easy. We picked a hydrolyzed soy protein, highly digestible diet. And we took away some of the other things like metronidazole and supplements. He struggled because the food restrictions of not having other things. For example, he wanted a bully stick. And when he had his bully stick, that was not such a good day. But to your earlier question, it was a good day in that he vomited up his spatula. And we didn't have to worry about that anymore. So overall, he did very well with food changes.
I think it's so funny you had the spatula in there for so long and then it came up with a bully stick.
he really did. He's a hoot. He's into everything. He's a busy guy. And we did make some changes along the way. For example, he constantly wanted more food. So we were able to add just a few green beans here and there would make him happy. And weight gain has been a challenge for him. He really, really likes his food. So that's a challenge. But these are good challenges. And I'm happy to report he just enjoyed his first snowfall this year. And we have wonderful pictures of him enjoying the snow. So we're really happy for him.
Oh, that's so great. And I would imagine, thinking about the fact that we're talking about two German shepherds with diarrhea here, you were probably the hero at the end of the day helping to clear up this diarrhea. That was probably a big mess and a huge headache for the owners. And getting these guys on the right food to fix this problem probably made a huge difference in everyone's quality of life.
Yeah, these guys are great. And it's truly an honor to be part of the care for these critters. They're really marvelous, and their families are extremely dedicated.
And we're talking about nutritional changes here in treating these patients. Is there any data on what percentage of patients will improve with just a food change alone?
There is limited information, but some more recent studies have looked at just enteropathies in dogs in general and found that 64 to 75%, about 2/3 to 3/4, will be food responsive, which is really, really cool. The remaining 25% will be 1 of 3 immunosuppressive, responsive to bacterial changes like dysbiosis or antibiotics, and some of them will not be responsive. So when we start to look at these guys, it's really very, very reasonable and probably should be our first course to look at diet, to look at food, to look at nutrition, to look at habitat, environment, parasites. But looking at what they're eating, looking at the fiber, looking at the protein, looking at the fat, making sure we have really, really good quality, consistent ingredients is the place to start for these guys. So, yeah, I think we'll be seeing a lot more information as time goes by about enteropathies and being able to change what we give them nutritionally to really help them and not just help them, but resolve and control their disease.
And I think that goes a little bit back to what you were talking about earlier, where sometimes we have to make sure, well, most of the time, we have to make sure we're being judicious with finances and targeting our diagnostics to make sure we're getting the most information possible and being familiar with the types of changes in therapeutic nutrition or lifestyle to help these patients. Knowing that so it can make a difference for so many animals, that can be a really great place to start.
Yeah, it really can. When you look back at these cases that we discussed, when those patients walked in the door, when they walked in and Mongo walked in skin and bones, and Pax walked in pretty solid with blood in his stool, we had some good ideas as to where to start and already had tools in our tool basket to help them without doing any diagnostics.
Absolutely. I think that's a really important point. Now, thinking about your treatment plan for these guys, and as they're improving, I'm imagining you were in contact with the owners. How were you asking the owners to monitor their response to treatment? What kind of monitoring techniques can we use to evaluate diarrhea and watch for improvement?
This comes to the crux of the matter that we do not fix this overnight. Right? This is a long journey and it can be tiring. It can be a lot of work for families at home. So I like to provide a couple of tools for that I use for us and for my clients to know how things are doing. One of my favorite tools is a fecal scoring chart, which basically is a pictorial representation of what does a stool look like in different stages of moisture? And can you share with me as we go along, is it better, same, or worse in a quantifiable way? So is it a score where it's totally watery puddles, or is it a hard log? Is it pick-upable? What's the texture? With when we use this fecal scoring chart to give a number to the character of the stool, when my colleague or my client calls me up and says, "Man, fecal score 7," I know they were up all night, and we need to do something today. Whereas if they say, "Well, it was a perfect 4 to 5, and then it was 6," that's a really short discussion, and we can not have to trade text messages of poop pictures and have long discussions of descriptive things that we just talk to each other about. So the fecal scoring chart is really, really helpful for us to use to know the status of the disease and how we need to respond to what's happening with the disease.
Absolutely. Yes. If there is a way to reduce the number of pictures of poop that get texted back and forth, I'm all for it. I have a surprising number of those pictures on my phone.
Yeah, too many, right?
Yes, absolutely. Okay, so fecal scoring chart, great for reducing the number of poop pictures on our phone. Any other monitoring tools we want to be aware of?
Yeah, another tool that I use, and I'll get into some of the details of this, but bear with me, is Canine Inflammatory Bowel Disease Activity Index, or CIBDAI. And this is something everybody can Google or look up. There's a really nice paper that looked at what characteristics do we see when you have diarrhea, assign each one a number, and then add them all up. So it's a pretty simple scoring system. So, for example, one of the characteristics might be appetite. Is it good? Normal? 0. If it's severely decreased, 3. So something like that. The reason that I like this is because when you're in this and taking care of a patient that has diarrhea or your pet, day in, day out, it can be really hard to keep perspective and not become discouraged. this scoring tool helps us say, well, yeah, it really was a lot worse last week or the week before, and the score is improving. And I can say, okay, we are making progress, or no, we're not making progress. One of the examples of helping us keep things in perspective is when we try and characterize vomiting on this scale, no vomiting would be normal. Mild would be once a week. We really don't want vomiting, but maybe once a week might be better than severe, which would be three times a week. So this scale, which is really easy, numerical scale, add it up, and at the end of the day, get a score, and you can say, okay, here's the score. It's better, same, or worse. We're making progress, or we're not making progress. We need to change something. Or I can say to my families, please hang in there. It's getting better. You're doing a great job. Give it a little more time. So I really like that score for staging and quantifying our progress.
Absolutely. And I think it kind of helps you establish that baseline of where you started, so that even if you don't get perfect resolution right off the bat, you can know if you're making progress in the right direction.
Yeah. Yeah. And it takes a long time. Sometimes it'll respond within 2 weeks, which is great. But sometimes it'll take a month or two or three.
Sure. But so just to make sure that we're not discounting those little improvements.
Yeah, we'll take our small wins.
Absolutely. And then, of course, there are prescription food companies that we can call and ask for these consults.
Yeah, they are great. If you haven't ever been stuck and said, I think for nutrition, I need highly digestible, I need low fat, and I need more fiber, or you, for some reason you have something in mind, or maybe you have a kidney failure patient or something like that, and you just can't get all the pieces together, those resources, those consultation sources, they're great. They're really phenomenal. They know their stuff, and they can say, nope, that's going to have too much of this. That's going to have too little of this. This one brings all those things together. And I am so grateful that we have these resources. We have excellent quality, data-driven nutritional intervention for our critters. It's really phenomenal, and we are so lucky.
Absolutely. I know I have certainly made those phone calls, and it's amazing to me. Like, it tends to be a pretty simple phone call of, okay, well, you have this going on. Here's your options and here's how to do it. And I'm just always amazed that, you know, whoever I'm talking to has that information right there at their fingertips.
Yeah. And I think they have it right in their head. They're pretty amazing.
I would agree. Absolutely. It's usually like a very efficient consultation, and I'm always shocked and amazed and very pleased at the end.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't all have to be nutritionists. We've got help.
Absolutely. Well, Dr. Miller, this has been such a fun talk. I know I've learned a lot. And then I think you've offered some really good reminders about how important it is to really take a good holistic look at our patients and what's going on with them, holistic with a W, and to understand some of these principles when it comes to therapeutic nutrition, because that in and of itself can provide a huge benefit to our patients. So thank you so much for joining me. Are there any final thoughts you want to share with everyone?
Absolutely. Well, yeah, just listen to your clients, listen to your critters, and keep up the good work. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this discussion.
Dr. Miller, thank you so much for joining me. I always love when we can break down these cases and learn about how you helped pets in these specific situations. So thank you so much for your insight and for your knowledge. Thank you to Hills for making this episode possible. Of course, thank you to everyone out there listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. It'll help other veterinary professionals like yourself find this and other great content that we try to put out there. For more episodes like this, click on the Education tab on the Vetfolio website. As always, we'd love to hear your input on this talk, as well as ideas for topics you'd like to hear from us in the future. Feel free to reach out to me at dvm@vetfolio.com. You can also find me on Facebook at Dr. Cassie DVM, and you can find me on LinkedIn. And remember, if one animal is better off because of you today, it's a great day.